It is Thursday, May 16th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. And KUAF is supported by our Segas at the Depot, located on Weston Dixon in Fayetteville. The Depot offers full table service for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, featuring coffee, crepes, salads, soups, and libations 7 days a week and weekend brunch. OurSegasDepot.com or Facebook, Our Segas at the Depot.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, bringing electricity to rural Arkansas, Christina talked with a veteran of Ozarks Rural Electric Co-op about wiring the rugged parts of our region as the agency celebrates its 75th anniversary.
Also, Medicaid coverage for many Marshall Islanders in northwest Arkansas might be restored 17 years after it was cut. Jacqueline Froelich has that report. And a smartphone app that might save your life. Really.
But first, now that the Justice Department is opening a criminal investigation into the practices of the Internal Revenue Service, Arkansas Senators John Bozeman and Mark Pryor want more answers from IRS officials. Senator Bozeman says there must be a thorough review of all documents that apparently show IRS agents singled out Tea Party groups applying for tax-exempt status.
I think everyone would like to determine the extent of the problem. Those that are guilty should be held accountable. People should be fired, and there might be cases if they've broken criminal statutes that they should be prosecuted, really to make an example of. This is behavior, regardless of the administration, that simply can't be tolerated.
Senator Pryor says there shouldn't be a rush to judgment until lawmakers have all the details.
One of the things I've learned in these scandals in Washington is the blame game goes full tilt, and a lot of people haul off and, you know, blame everybody in the world before they know all the facts. I don't know all the facts, but I know the Senate Finance Committee is going to be doing some hearings, and I look forward to watching this very closely. But I just think we shouldn't tolerate political activity by the IRS.
Friday, the IRS publicly acknowledged it used extra scrutiny when reviewing the applications of conservative groups.
The 2014 governor's race has five announced candidates already, but other state races are filling more slowly. There's currently just one candidate announced for Arkansas Attorney General, Republican David Sterling of North Little Rock. He tells Talk Business Arkansas that if elected, he'll defend conservative abortion restrictions passed in the recent legislative session that are being challenged for their constitutionality in court.
Slavery was constitutional at one point in our nation's history, and right now abortion is constitutional under Roe v. Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood.
Sterling says despite abortion being ruled constitutional, he'll fight it by defending the state's new laws.
Bill Halter's gubernatorial campaign is drawing the scorn of Arkansas State University for the campaign's use of the phrase Arkansas Promise. ASU has trademarked the phrase for its Arkansas Promise scholarship. Jeff Hankins, a vice president with ASU, says the campaign's use creates the potential for confusion.
We expressed concern about possible student and parent confusion regarding the program, and we thought that the campaign would like to know about the trademark infringement as early as possible so they could make possible adjustments to their campaign.
Bud Jackson, a spokesman with the Halter campaign, says the use of the words Arkansas Promise is within the campaign's legal rights.
We've had discussions about this. Their position is this is a trademark of their scholarship. Their name is the Arkansas Promise Scholarship. You know, our position is we don't have a scholarship. It's just a campaign's public policy plan, and that the trademark doesn't really apply. And furthermore, we've consulted with our own attorneys who are experts in trademark law, and they've said that the trademark really isn't even valid.
Jeff Hankins says ASU will continue to explore legal defenses to protect the trademark.
Arkansas Department of Higher Ed Director Shane Broadway says expected cuts to state scholarship programs will affect students applying for those awards for this coming school year and beyond. He says during the recent legislative session, the department didn't get a requested additional $7 million to shore up estimated shortfalls, but did get $2 million to save the governor's distinguished scholarships, which go to 300 high-achieving students.
Now that the session is over, we are going through our processes and beginning to notify all of the programs outside the governor's distinguished that we have to make reductions to those programs. To the tune of about $5 million.
Broadway says other than the governor's distinguished scholarship, awards will be cut across the board, which will affect award funds for military personnel and families, as well as medical students going to school out of state.
One more trail connection is coming soon to Lake Fayetteville, specifically to the northwest corner of the lake. Matt Mihalovich, the city's trails coordinator, says when the section stretching between the marina and the North Shore Disc Golf Course is complete, the entire paved loop will fit nicely into other paved trail developments at the lake.
We just completed and actually are having a ribbon cutting on Saturday for the southern section. That's about a one-mile piece. That was our final phase of the paved loop. It completes the paved loop, but we still had this section on the north, but in the marina, where it was shared with the roadway, which worked for the time being, but with the amount of use that we're seeing out there, it's just tremendous amount of use on these trails. We just feel like this is a great opportunity to pull the people away from the road and make it a little bit safer.
Mihalovich says separating bike and pedestrian traffic from car traffic makes sense. As more of the loop around the lake has been paved, more people are using the trails.
As we've seen, the more phases get connected, and now with the loop complete, before people had to turn around if they wanted to stay on the paved surface, and now they can come around back to Veterans Park and complete that loop. We are counting out there, and we're just seeing really, really high counts of use, and which is great. People are loving it.
The new trail connection is being paid for in part by a $75,000 federal grant announced by the Arkansas Highway Transportation Department earlier this week. Mihalovich says the trail will take about 4 months to complete, but construction won't likely begin until early 2014. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals lost their third straight to the Arkansas Travelers last night, 5-1 in North Little Rock. It's the fourth loss overall for the Nats. The four-game set at Dickey Stevens Park in North Little Rock concludes tonight.
Forecast calls for a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas, with a 40% chance in the Arkansas River Valley. Overnight lows from 60 to 64 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly cloudy with a 20% chance for rain and a high of 79 in northwest Arkansas. Mostly cloudy with a high of 82 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, cloudy with lows in the mid-60s. As the temperatures warm and layers of clothing come off, our skin begins to show. Many people may notice strange bumps or moles that have grown from last summer. Fitting that May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. Earlier this month, a group of doctors at Ozark Dermatology Clinic in Fayetteville rolled out a new online dermatology app, just in time for Melanoma Monday last Monday. About 30% of dermatologists in Arkansas came on board to diagnose skin issues of about 100 patients across the state. I mean, we use our smartphones for everything else. Why not for healthcare? The idea for the app was about 4 years in the making. It began with a website, the Online Dermatology Clinic, which really came about, says Dr. Christopher Schock, out of frustrations of being a dermatologist.
One of the frustrations in our practice, and with every dermatologist that we hear from our patients, is how long it takes to get in to be seen, because there's a relatively few number of dermatologists. And so that's one problem. The other problem is in medical training, only dermatologists really get trained to examine the skin and to diagnose the skin. And so primary care doctors don't have that much background in it. So we came up with an idea of how to share information with primary care doctors, give access to our patients, give more expedited access to patients. And so we thought, why don't we use our computers and smartphones? And so we created a whole video tutorial program where we have doctors teaching patients with videos online. And then over time, we just kind of together developed the idea of using teledermatology.
The photographs with smartphones are so good now. Dr. Schock says that when properly trained, a dermatologist can diagnose a problem with a picture in about 80 to 90% of cases. He likens it to me going to a basketball game.
If you were to go to Bud Walton Arena and your aunt was there, I wouldn't know who she was, but you'd know her as soon as you'd pick her out of the crowd of 17,000. You know exactly what she looks like, and it's the same thing for a dermatologist. You know, when you see a rash or a skin cancer, for the most part, it's instant recognition. And so, That's why teledermatology works so well.
As Dr. Schock mentioned earlier, it takes a while to get into a dermatologist. There are so few, partly due to the extensive training the specialization requires. After 4 years of medical school, there's 1 year of training in general medicine, then 3 more years to train in dermatology. He says the app serves as teletriage to determine if a patient needs to come in, if at all, and get the patients that need to come in quickly.
You know, there are cases where people have melanoma and go for months waiting to be seen. And by the time they finally get in, that cancer can be more advanced. And in some places, the wait is over 6 months to see a dermatologist, and that's unacceptable. I guarantee you, if that doctor had known that a patient had a melanoma, that person would not wait 6 months. The doctors want those patients seen more quickly, and this is a triage, an effective way to triage patients and get them in.
Early detection is key in curing melanoma and other skin cancers. If found early, they say the cure rate is almost 100% with minor procedures. But once it breaks free from the skin, the 5-year survival rate is low. Here's Dr. Eric Stewart on melanoma.
Of course, there's different kinds with different levels of severity, and of course, the most serious type being melanoma. And bad thing about melanoma a lot of times is it's asymptomatic. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't itch many times, and people don't realize that something that's so asymptomatic could be such a problem. And so the ability to see more melanomas and more unusual moles through this system, hopefully if we can just catch a few of these that someone who doesn't have time to come into clinic or is, you know, nervous about coming into the doctor, if we can just catch a few of these this way, then it would be worth it.
The doctors diagnosed at least 4 cases of skin cancer in the week leading up to Melanoma Monday through use of the app, and they're still waiting for more statistics to come in. In preparation for my interview with the doctors, Dr. Schock suggested I download the free online Derm Clinic app and try it out just to see how easy it is to use. It was easy. I had to create an account, which didn't take long. Dr. Schock had given me a promo code, because there is a fee, but it's similar to the copay at most doctor's offices. I was able to choose my doctor, and I chose Dr. Schock. It's best to find one in your area. Then I took a picture. At first, I wasn't sure that I had anything that needed to be checked out. Then I remembered a small pinkish bump on my chest that had actually been drawing my attention for a few months. I took 3 pictures of it in my bathroom, late on a Sunday evening, and submitted them. When I arrived to my desk on Monday morning, Dr. Schock had sent a response to my email inbox. Here's what it looked like from his end.
Right, so this is the doctors have their own end where they log into it, okay? So it's separate from the patient end. So I'm going to go ahead and get into the chart. I'm going to go to your report, because that one, this is your medical record, so you get to see it. But this is our view. And so we've got these buttons on this side that have function, tell the doctor what they can do with this. When they see the report, they have different functions. They can send a report. They can send it with a disclaimer, which is what we sent you, saying that, hey, this looks worrisome. You're going to need to be evaluated in person. There'll be a diagnosis, too, that you get to read about. But this is a disclaimer, letting the patient know that, trying to emphasize the fact that this may be a skin cancer.
Kind of scary, right? Dr. Schock says all of this information is stored on HIPAA-secured servers.
And there's your information, and here are the images we get to see. We have this nice little tool that zooms your image. We can see that this, in your case, is this little pink little bump, kind of a nondescript pink bump, and then I can read your history that you say that it's been present for a few months.
It's pretty high-tech. The doctors worked with high-tech people in developing this program. Here's Dr. Stewart and Dr. Kevin St. Clair on how easy it is for the doctors to use.
And the ease for the doctor of making this work was really his work. I mean, Chris did such a good job of storyboarding this to make each button intuitive and work properly to come out smoothly for the doctor as well as the patient. So
the patient is notified the report is ready via email. They'll get to receive an email saying, hey, your report's ready. You'll sign in. You also have the opportunity to ask questions. If you have a question, you can ask the doctor. The doctor will receive an email and can respond through the site via email.
I didn't have any questions because I knew I'd be in that day, though I was not prepared to be taken into the exam room. But that's exactly where Dr. Shock led me. I sat in a fancy new chair under those big bright lights and let him check me out. The app eliminates some of that intimidation because many cases can be solved via the app.
So there are a couple different things that can do that. One of them is called a Spitz nevus. It's a type of a mole. Usually Spitz nevi are removed. We actually surgically excise them because a very small percentage of Spitz nevi can actually be skin cancer, in fact, be melanoma type skin cancer. And so when we're looking at things like this, we want to think, okay, what's worst case scenario? We don't want to miss something, right? Do no harm. So when you have a little nondescript, little pink bump that's relatively new, not going away, it's not a pimple, it's not a ruptured cyst, those should go away in a couple of weeks. In this case, you do need a little skin biopsy there.
And so he biopsied it. I'll get my results next week. The doctors say they had a good time developing the program and learning about the technology side of it. But their favorite part is the first-of-its-kind humanitarian aspect of it, things like Melanoma Monday. But also, a local pediatric clinic will be going to parts of Mexico this summer, and they'll be using it. They'll be sending images to the United States, here in Fayetteville, to solve problems in Mexico.
You know, one of the things that all of us do when we get out in medicine is, you know, we want to, you know, make a difference. You're trying to help people.
To get started, from your computer, go to onlinedermclinic.com. From your smartphone, download the free Online Derm Clinic app from iTunes or Google Play. This is Ozarks at Large.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, still more new blues releases like Jimmy Vivino and the Black Italians, Papa Chubby, Arthur Big Boy Crudup, Peter Novelli, J.J. Gray and Mofro. Here this Friday night at 9 o'clock on the Generic Blues Show. We'll see you then.
In about 6 minutes on this edition of Ozarks, Wiring the Rugged Parts of Arkansas, Christina talks to a veteran of Ozarks Electric Cooperative who helped bring electricity to rural Arkansas. The U.S. Congress is considering reinstating Medicaid coverage for Compact of Free Association migrants cut back in 1996. Among those affected, residents of the Republic of the Marshall Islands who now reside in the U.S., including Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this explanation.
Compact of Free Association migrants are not immigrants. They're residents from nations that have struck military, political, and economic agreements with the United States. As a consequence, migrants are free to travel to the U.S. to live and work for as long as they wish. Before 1996, freely associated migrants were privy to Medicaid under the status of legally residing non-citizen nationals. But the passage of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act in 1996 ended the entitlement. States with the highest population of migrants, Hawaii, California, Washington, and Arkansas, were left to fend for themselves. But now Congress will consider COFRA migrant Medicaid restoration legislation as part of comprehensive immigration reform. Because of legislation introduced in early February by the Democratic Hawaiian delegation led by Senator Mazie Hirono, along with Representative Colleen Hanabusa. Paolo Pointemayor is advisor for government relations and external affairs for the nonprofit Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum based in Washington, D.C.
So this issue has been one that many members of the Pacific delegation, so elected officials from all over the Pacific, have been trying to address for the past several years. So most notably, when the Senator Hirono was a member of Congress in the House side, she actually filed legislation in the 112th Congress that Congresswoman Hanabusa later adopted and refined when Senator Hirono was elected.
If passed, an estimated 56,000 compact migrants in the United States will be affected. The 2010 census counted 4,300 Marshallese living in Arkansas, but that figure is considered too low by advocates. The cost for unreimbursed health care for Hawaiian migrants, for example, is around $45 million. In Arkansas, prenatal care is available regardless of immigration status. But even the state's Medicaid program for children called Our Kids is not conveyed to Marshallese children, numbering around 1,600. And reinstating Medicaid won't burden U.S. taxpayers, given that employed migrants pay income, Social Security, and Medicaid, Medicare taxes.
Compacts of Free Association migrants, by virtue of them being able to work in the U.S. without, going through kind of those employment visas that immigrants who would possibly be coming into it through that process, actually do pay into the system with a lot of the entitlement pieces. If they do receive a paycheck, a portion of that is deducted for payroll taxes by their employer. That actually funds a lot of the programs that we think the federal government runs. Additionally, by virtue of the fact that they are actually active purchasers in a state like Arkansas, they pay sales taxes, which we all know sales taxes fund general revenue for governments, which, because of Medicaid being a state and federal share program, part of the state share is funded by state revenues. And so there is that notion that COFA migrants being able to pay into the system but not getting their benefits is also one of those longstanding injustice issues.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, after encouraging debate, approved Senator Hirono's amendment as part of comprehensive immigration reform.
Sure, it was very exciting watching the hearing yesterday as Senator Hirono presented her testimony for support of Hirono number 15, which is her amendment. Chairman Leahy actually used that as an opportunity to talk about our responsibility to the Pacific, especially as a result of nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands and kind of the post-World War II period of the U.S. being in the Pacific, and currently today the Pacific being a very strategic place for defense policy and military policy in general. Senator Schumer also remarked about how this would not be an undue burden because of the small nature of the population. This amendment is actually paid for using some of the fees and penalties that are found in the comprehensive immigration reform legislation.
The measure now awaits approval as part of comprehensive immigration reform.
Yes, and I think the messaging around this strategy was, although COFA migrants are not immigrants by any means, because of their status, they also have very similar access issues that immigrants face. And so I think because of that, Senator Hirono saw that this was an opportunity to move legislation that is really misunderstood or not really understood by anyone in the Senate.
With freely associated citizen migration expected to increase in coming years, advocates say timing is critical to help states better manage health care costs. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
When we flip a light switch, we expect that light to turn on. Frustration ensues if it doesn't. Even panic. I remember the ice storm of 2009. I didn't have power for 3 weeks. That was tough. But not all that long ago, living without electricity was a fact of life for many. Growing up on the outskirts of Stillwell, Oklahoma, Burl Wilkie remembers when his family lived without power.
Before we had anything like that, my mother actually took the wash to the creek and washed her clothes down near the creek, boiled the water in kettles and washed the clothes and hung them around on whatever lines she could put up down near the creek so that wouldn't have to draw so much water from the well or carry it from springs or whatever. We all, after supper was over, we would be all ganged around the table doing homework, trying to see, get enough light just to everybody be able to, maybe five or six people trying to use one lamp to do their work.
At the age of 12, Burl's family got electricity. The year was 1944. He fondly remembers being the first of 11 brothers and sisters to make it home from school that afternoon, the first to see lights on in their home. Fitting that he would later go on to spend a career working for Ozarks Electric Cooperative Corporation. The company celebrates its 75th birthday tomorrow. In the year 1938, people in town had electricity, but in the outskirts of town and most rural areas, they did not. It wasn't economically feasible for companies to lay lines to the rural areas. It was expensive bringing it to just a few people. Original monies for Ozarks Electric were borrowed from the government through the Rural Electrification Act. But in order to get that loan, they had to get enough people on board. Hence, the company is member-owned to this day. So they went around gathering signatures. They had to get 4 members per mile of line. Penny Storms is manager of communications for Ozarks Electric.
It was a matter of going around to houses and signing up and saying, if we had electricity out here, would you sign up? Would you pay $5 to become a member? They had to get signatures on paper and $5 paid to get electricity brought to them and to get the money from REA.
I can remember when that happened at my house, that the guy came around. We had thought that it would still be forever before we could get electricity, and this guy came along. The guy, he eventually was my foreman at work, but he would just be going around soliciting membership at that time. And he had to really kind of talk my dad into putting up the $5 because he didn't really have an extra $5 just to give somebody and never see anything come back from it or whatever. But then we were not sure we could pay even the minimum electric bill every month either. But we went ahead and signed up. And
2 years later, the first Ozarks Electric lights were turned on. Much to my excitement, the founder gave a live radio address the day prior, says Penny.
And the first lines were actually energized west of Springdale, kind of close to the Taneytown area. And on the day they were energized, there were 50 miles of line, and then the lights came on for 150 homes. So for us, that was huge.
A year and a half later, they were supplying electricity to 1,000 homes. Burrell remembers the first things that his family purchased when they got electricity. An iron for his mother, a refrigerator, an electric well pump.
And after about 15 years, I helped my brothers and I went together, and I rewired my parents' home, and the other two brothers bought an electric range. And of course, no cook really wants to give up the wood stove, so my mother insisted hers was set up out in the yard, so when she went to, she could still go out there.
Burrell went to work for Ozarks Electric in 1956, the first of 38 years with the company. The first several years, he spent time building lines to areas and to individual houses. It was tough manual labor, using all hand tools to dig holes and cut down trees. But he says it was worth it.
Right. That was one of the great things in those early days, to see the joy on people's faces when they knew they had it for the very first time. And even though it had been in the area, some of those people lived back in more remote places, it was hard for them to.
As city limits expanded in the 1950s and 60s, private electric companies could steal the service rights to that area, causing fights between the co-ops and the private companies, and threatening the life of Ozarks Electric. Here's Penny Storms.
Originally, Ozarks Electric name was Ozarks Rural Electric Cooperative Corporation. In the 60s, whenever we became more urban and less rural, they dropped the rural from the name, so it is now Ozarks Electric Cooperative Corporation. But the 50s, whenever they were sort of against each other and fighting for services, in the 70s came along and they built Flint Creek Power Plant over in Gentry. And actually, the co-ops and the investor-owned utilities worked together and have, exactly, 50-50.
What was a farmstead in the middle of a field, in many places, is now a subdivision with hundreds of homes. Today, the co-op has 68,000 members in eastern Oklahoma and western Arkansas, which is reason enough to celebrate.
Celebrating 75 years and the prospect of many, many more, of continuing to serve, providing power for people, a basic need we feel, and I think most people who enjoy electricity would feel that way. There are probably people in the world who don't have electricity, who don't know how nice it is. But we look forward to continuing to evolve and seeing how we can serve others and how we can empower. We power the communities, but we empower our members to be able to have a better quality of life for themselves and for their families, and that is something that's very important to us.
Even though Burrell retired nearly 20 years ago, he has maintained a relationship with the company. He says they treated him well, and it's like family. Burrell Wilkie will be featured in a commemorative book chronicling the history of the company and the area. A formal dedication for the book will be held tomorrow at 11 at the company's main office on Weddington Drive in Fayetteville. Those celebrations will be held at all four locations, also in Springdale, Stillwell, and Westville, Oklahoma, all day long. The public is invited to attend. For more information, OzarksECC.com/75years.
Bonus points if you recognize that tune, When Electricity Came to Arkansas by Black Oak, Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large. If you ever want to know more information about any of the music you hear inside our program, you can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. This weekend, several area high schools will bring out the pomp and circumstance for graduation, as will Northwest Arkansas Community College and the University of Arkansas School of Law. Last weekend, a record number of University of Arkansas students received diplomas, and those earning a degree from the Fay Jones School of Architecture heard a commencement address from Susan Seisnacy, the editor-in-chief of Metropolis Magazine. The publication, based in Manhattan, is a leading journal of design and architecture. During her visit to Northwest Arkansas, Susan went to Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, toured some of our farmers' markets, and came to our studio. Her own college degrees are in history, but a post-graduation job at a trade magazine for the food service industry helped lead to her eventual post at Metropolis. But as she pointed out during our conversation, history and architecture dovetail quite nicely.
History is the backstory for design. And then, of course, as I studied history, I studied architecture history, design history. I traveled a great deal on my own. So, and when you travel, you see architecture. And it became like a destination. I wanted to see buildings. I wanted to see city streets. I wanted to see how everything interrelated. I wanted to see the street wall of shops and how the signage kind of worked all together to create a place. I wanted to see parks. So it just became so interesting to me. And then I always tried to make the context for it. Somehow that it didn't spring out of a virgin mind, but it really was settled in a very fertile mind that was paved with history. And to me, that was the kind of the best thing that could have happened to me.
We all experience design and architecture. We don't all think about it when we're experiencing it, like you do or colleagues of yours do. Do you think we have enough conversations about how we use space and architecture and how it affects our lives?
See, I think our societal conversation about design is very superficial. I mean, everything that you see, especially now that there are so few magazines, so few design magazines, and so few sort of really researched ideas put out there. There's a lot of blogs. There's a lot of information out there. But there's not that fundamental questioning of things. It's about it looks good, I'll buy it, I'll trade it in, I'll live in it. That's how we think about it. And that's a very good way to begin the conversation because then you can experience it. Just like your offices, you have this kind of wonderful feeling that it was designed for you. It's not some sort of extruded thing. It's about you here at this radio station who need a beautiful place to work and connection to nature and connection to each other. So when you begin to realize that's what design does, that it connects and it provides a scenery for human activity, then it becomes really interesting.
I know you enjoy talking to young people who are going out into the workforce. And I think one reason is because, well, they're the next couple of generations who could change things for the better or hopefully not the worse.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and during your visit here today, you'll be talking to people who will have degrees in just moments after you're done talking to them.
Moments,
yeah.
Yes.
That's exciting, I bet.
That's very exciting. I love being in schools. I love talking to students and young designers because they aren't at that stage where they have to deal with the difficult problems of life. They're not paying mortgages and they're not looking at the kids' braces. And, when life takes over, it's a little bit harder to concentrate on on things that you want to invent. You want to see the world in a different way. And I think it doesn't mean that it shouldn't. It couldn't happen. But I think at those young ages, you're just so fresh and ready and without bounds. I mean, you should be. You should be really crazy when you're young. You should think about really wonderful things that could happen, and then work toward those to make them happen. So I'm very excited to be here and to be part of this wonderful place where architecture is interesting. I mean, you have a beautiful downtown. You have the Faye Jones buildings. You have a beautiful natural setting. So it combines everything that we're all looking for around the world. And I think these kids are very lucky to be coming out of here and coming out with the ammunition that they have so that they can now begin to think about these big ideas.
Well, when thinking about the future, you have a growing middle class in India and China. You have billions of people. We're going to have a billion more in about 20 years. Resources are becoming scarcer. Will architecture and design have to change because of this?
Architecture and design are changing because of this. And for the past 10 years, we have had a major shift in the way architecture and design are done. We're much more careful about what products we use, how we build our buildings, where we site them, how we use sun, how we use the sun's heat and light, how we use water and filter it, and how do we reclaim it. Not enough has been done because this is just the beginning. I mean, we have a rating system now for green buildings. It's a very good first step, but I consider it a primitive first step because, you know, I want to see buildings that breathe. I want to see buildings that recycle their water and reuse it. I want to see buildings that produce their own energy. I want to see buildings that grow things and food and vegetation and are part of the natural environment and connect to each other. And so I see this sort of larger organic unity of built environment and natural environment and human environment, which is very exciting to think about because we're on the brink of that. We're seeing that. We're seeing the thinking. We're seeing the experiments already. So, and I think for the students, this is a great time because they can watch who's doing what and elaborate on those and create some of the iterations themselves.
And that extends not just to buildings, but landscapes.
Absolutely.
Gardens, not lawns, yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was very interesting because I was in a city that reclaimed its waterfront and I was so happy. And then I realized how they reclaim the waterfront. It's all chemically dependent grass. We don't do that anymore. We shouldn't do that anymore. We should think about what are the native soils and grasses or vegetation. How do you populate that place with vegetation so that you don't have to water it? What is it that will make it work for that region, for that waterfront, for that culture? And we're asking all those questions now. So I think the chemically dependent humans and the chemically dependent lawns and the chemically dependent buildings are sort of gonna go away, although we have a huge stock of buildings that are that way and we're gonna have to adjust.
I'm gonna take a guess, and I bet you like to be surprised. I bet you like to go to a new place and go, wow, I didn't expect that, or I've never really seen something like that.
Oh, that's what I live for. I mean, I'm always looking for what is it that I can find, and especially in the built environment and people. I mean, I always find people wherever I am that say something or do something or work on something that is really exciting. And then I go away a little bit richer than when I got there first. So, yeah, that's very important to me.
If someone were given an unlimited budget and they could go and you could advise them to go to a city or a place to see spectacular design, where would you tell them to go?
Well, there are many places, but I think the place that I go to every year is small hill towns in Tuscany. Mm-hmm. Because I find that the organic quality of those places and how they were designed and how they managed the breezes to come up to the mountaintop and how they designed hundreds of years ago the not just the ventilation but the shading and the interior spaces and the buildings themselves and the water flow out of down the hillside. It just is so smart, and we have not learned from those. We throw mechanical solutions at everything, and if we observe those places, I think we're so much richer. And also, well, let's not forget, the food is great, and the art is spectacular. So, I mean, you want to go to places where everything comes together.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not necessarily a coincidence that the art and the food and the architecture is all wonderful.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a sense of aesthetic. There's a sense of beauty without it being belabored. I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that Japan kind of pulled that out in me, too. I mean, Tokyo not so much, but Nara and places like that where there's smaller scale and beautiful old and new kind of together and see the sensibilities working, and the food is spectacular there, too. And just the clothing and the behavior and the kind of niceness of people. I mean, where do you get on the bullet train and the conductor comes to the door and he bows to you, bows to the car? I mean, that kind of gesture, that human gesture, and in addition to the gestures of the built environment and how people get around, is really important. So I think it's a combination.
Thank you so much for your time. Welcome to Northwest Arkansas.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Susan Saiznacy is the editor-in-chief of Metropolis Magazine. I talked to her last Saturday morning, just a few hours before she addressed the 2013 graduating class of the University of Arkansas Faye Jones School of Architecture.
Mozart may have had an aversion to the flute, but he did write for the instrument, especially when he was commissioned to do so. One of those pieces is his Concerto for Flute, Harp, and Orchestra in C major. A member of the French aristocracy, Comte de Guin, commissioned the piece. He was a flutist, his daughter a harpist. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Note, which airs the best in classical music Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KUAF Public Radio. Join me Friday for Mozart's Concerto for Flute, Harp, and Orchestra in C major, performed by Emmanuel Pahoud Flute, Marie-Pierre Langlemet Harp, and the Berlin Philharmonic, led by Claudio Abbado. That's coming up Friday from 11 to noon on your source for classical music, KUAF, and streaming online at KUAF.com.
We continue our week-long series on summer camps that will be in session beginning in just a few weeks. Today, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis takes a closer look at one of the drama camps for youngsters this year.
The calendar for the next few months is filled with drama camps for children aching to stretch their acting bones. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts is offering its Broadway in Review Camp for children aged 5 through 14 on July 22nd through 27th. Theater Squared is offering its Summer Academy for students aged 10 through 18, presenting Shakespeare's As You Like It, with the camp running from July 15th through 26th. And Arts Live Theater has several camps scheduled from June through the beginning of August for 5-year-olds to 18-year-olds. And returning this summer are the Academy camps at Trike Theater. The camps are for children ranging from age 4 all the way through 12th grade. Megan James, Trike Theater's Dramatic Book Club director, says that the wide range of ages leads to a wide range of themes for different camps.
So we're offering superhero camps, explorers, the Wild Wild West, improv, and musical theater. Lots of really exciting different experiences for the age group. And there'll be performance experiences, but they'll also just be engaging, creative storytelling experiences as well.
For the youngest of actors, ranging in age from 4 years old up to second graders, fine arts camps are one of the offerings.
The kids get to explore three different styles of art. So they get to do movement and drama and then visual art. And so they get to explore all those different things, and they go from each class, and it's under a theme. So if we're doing explorers, we'll be exploring art under those different themes.
The Superheroes Camp will be held in Bentonville from June 10th through the 14th. Also in Bentonville, Wild Wild West will be held June 17th through the 21st. Knights, Princesses, and Dragons will be held July 8th through 12th in Bentonville and the afternoons of July 15th through 18th in Fayetteville. And the Explorers Camps will run from June 24th through 28th in Bentonville and July 15th through 18th in Fayetteville. But for children who prefer acting to storytelling, Megan James says that there is a camp for that.
The Young Actors is more of a performing experience. So they'll build the sets and their costumes, and then they'll have a script and they'll get to perform. It's not a super high-tech experience, but they get to be a part of every aspect of it.
The Young Actors camps run from June 24th through the 28th and from July 15th through 11th in Bentonville. And in Fayetteville, the camp runs July 22nd through the 26th. In addition to the camps for the extremely young, track offerings for children in grades 3 through 8 include Young Company Camp running July 15th through 19th in Bentonville, which is a camp geared to the young improv, musical, and comedic actors, and the Girl Power Arts Camp for children in 3rd through 6th grades running July 8th through 12th in Bentonville. Megan James says that all of the camps are extremely popular.
We have a very high turnout. I think we had as many as 30 kids in some of our fine arts camps last year. So it's very exciting when you have that many kids because the energy is so exciting. And it's just so great to have that many kids and all those different ideas.
As far as handling the sometimes overwhelming amount of energy from a group of a couple dozen children, she says that the folks at Trike are pros at wrangling the young actors.
I actually prefer the camps when we have a large amount of kids. In the camps where we have 30 kids, they're very rarely in the room at the same time. That's why we do the three different things that they can go to, because then we can split them up based on age groups, and then they can go from station to station and try all the different things, and we can put them in groups of 10 or 12 and then split them up that way.
While the registration for a particular camp is generally the night before a camp begins, Megan James says that the sooner you register your child, the better. For registration and more information, visit triketheater.org. And for links to some of the other drama camps happening in the area, visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
It is Thursday, May 16th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us again, Jody Beznoska, Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center. Welcome back, Jody.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Tonight.
Come on down to Walton Arts Center because you can be part of the Price is Right Live. There are tickets left for it. I think it's going to be a riot. It will have a nice full house. And if you have, you can sign up either via email. I think you can get the information off our website, or you can come just a little bit early and you can sign up to actually potentially be a contestant. And so if you find your way on stage, you could actually win prizes. And I was remembering some of the rules yesterday. It's like if you get within $100 of the price of the Showcase Showdown.
Mm-hmm. You get them both.
You get them both.
You
yeah,
do.
That's crazy. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock.
Well, without going over.
Right.
Within 100 without, you go
right.
over by a dollar
right.
and you're out
done.
Of luck.
You're yeah. done, yeah. So that's tonight at 7 p.m. And then this weekend, we've got a couple of really fun Artist Fair things going on. We have actually a lot of fun Artist Fair things going on. We have Grug, 10 a.m., 12 p.m., and 2 p.m. It's another sort of puppetry show from Australia, and Grug is a little haystack looking character, and this is one of those shows that is good for the littles, ages 1 through 6. You know, it's bright and interesting enough that it will command their attention. So, and tickets are only $5. There's 3 shows. So again, that's Saturday, that's the 18th, 10 a.m., 12 p.m., and 2 p.m. Also Saturday morning at 9:30 will be the Urban Challenge with the Clubhouse Fitness. I don't remember where it starts, so you can go to our website, artistfairfestival.org, and find out where it begins. But that's going to be a very cool if you like such things, you know, running through the city and climbing stairs and looking at urban views and basically sweating while you're exploring Fayetteville. Also on the 18th, out at Lake Fayetteville, there is an event called Parkapalooza, which is being done by the Parks and Recreation Department at the city. We will be there sort of ribbon cutting, kicking off the Spiral Wetland Project. I think that happens at around 11 o'clock, but there's all kinds of great activities happening out at the lake, 5Ks and fun walks and, you know, things going on for kids. So I think that's in the morning on Saturday, but you can come out and visit Spiral Wetland, which is done now, and we'll be out on the lake for about a year. It's this beautiful sculpture that helps clean up the water. Then Sunday, we will actually be out at the Naturals. There's a Naturals game on Sunday, and Walton Arts Center will be out there doing a Scooby-Doo-themed mystery scavenger hunt at the park. And then we'll be at the Block Party, because Block Party is happening all day, I believe,
right,
on Block Street here in Fayetteville. And we'll be there with Sunboxes, which is another of our Artisphere projects created by an artist out of Rogers called Craig Colarusso. And they were out on our plaza a couple days ago. I don't know if you guys could hear them, but they're solar-powered boxes that have little computers in them that generate this tone, and they make a chord. There's a full list of where you can see the Sunboxes on the Artisphere Festival website. So lots going on this weekend, and then next week we get right into Warhorse. We've been waiting for Warhorse for a long time. There's no show on Tuesday like a normal Broadway run. The shows begin on Wednesday the 22nd, I believe. This is the Tony-winning play. It's not a musical, but it does have music. And it's a story. It's based on a children's book, and it's a story of a boy who raises a horse, and then the horse gets sent off to World War I, and the boy goes after him. It's the Handspring Puppet Company out of South Africa, and so it's a real treat to get this. This is the first national tour of Warhorse. The only other places that have seen it would be London and New York and the few other stops that have come before us. So it's really
exciting.
Yeah, it's really great. I'm looking forward to it. I will probably see it four or five times. So that runs through the 26th. After that, we have Scooby-Doo, Musical Mysteries happening. We've got three or four shows of that. I think that's the 27th and the 28th of May. And then we will be into June, and we'll be beginning the second wave of Artisphere with our classical music programming.
Absolutely.
All kinds of goodness going on with classical music stuff.
All right. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Jody Besnoska is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night beginning at 10 p.m. On this Saturday's show, we'll hear music from Japanese pianist Hiromi, and we'll also hear from McCoy Tyner, Andrew Distel, Jeff Marks, and tenor saxophonist Chris Potter. This and much more on the Saturday edition of Shades of Jazz.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. Volunteers are needed for the 8th Annual West Fork Watershed Cleanup, Saturday, May 25th, from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Riverside Park in West Fork. It's located off Highway 170. Cleanup gear, lunch, refreshments, and door prizes will be provided. More information is available by calling 225-1611 or online bwdh20.org.
A note, tomorrow night marks the opening of the 5th annual KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival. First concert this year in the Great Hall at Crystal Bridges. You need to make, if you haven't made a reservation,
it's too late.
Out of luck. Right. It is officially, I don't know if sold out would be the correct term here, because it was free, but you had to make reservations. It's reservationed out.
It's so full.
It's full. That's it. It's full. Thank you. So thanks to everyone who's made a reservation.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Westville, Oklahoma.
Westville, Oklahoma. Been there many times. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow. We'll have Carter Sampson in the studio. We'll be back together Sunday morning.
We will.